Welcome to Inside the Spec. We are the podcast that bridges the gap between building product manufacturers and the architects who specify them. Each episode brings you unfiltered insights into how architects find, evaluate, and specify building materials. I'm your co-host, Megan Kavinsky, and CEO of Point to Point. We're an advertising agency focused in securing the architect's spec through results-focused marketing. And I'm joined by my co-host, Vardhan Mehta, a second-gen architect and founder of AceLab. AceLab is an AI-driven product selection platform that brings architects and manufacturers together early in the design process.
Whether you're a manufacturer looking to better serve the architectural community or a supplier seeking to understand the evolving needs of design professionals, Inside the Spec delivers actionable intelligence straight from the source. Inside the Spec, because understanding how architects think is the first step to becoming the architect standard.
Hello, and welcome to Inside the Spec. I'm your co-host, Megan Kavinsky, CEO of Point to Point, and I'm joined by the fabulous Vardhan Mehta, CEO of AceLab. Today, we are joined by the very esteemed Caitlin Brady. Welcome, Caitlin. Super happy to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah. So we're really excited about having Caitlin here for two reasons. The first is she's just an amazing architect. She's got a ton of experience leading really complex projects. She's super collaborative. She really is innovative and thinks about things differently. But the second part is she is a podcaster as well. So Caitlin is very focused on helping elevate and empower women within the field of architecture. And to that end, she has started a podcast called The Architect Et, where she really amplifies the voices of women in architecture, helping them share their stories and inspire generations of women to come. So thanks, Caitlin, for being with us today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. And Caitlin's going to talk to us about winning the spec game early. So really talking about how early engagement can turn your product into something that's essential to that particular project. And then that you can use that to drive specification success with similar project types or with that same architectural firm over time. So we're going to really be focusing on how to make your products top of mind early in the architectural design phases. But we want to start with our favorite first question, which is, why did you become an architect?
Yeah, so I think we joked about before, you know, I played with Legos, yeah, the Lincoln Logs, all of that. But I think growing up, I always was really interested in building and designing and creating space. Whether, you know, when I had dolls growing up, I played more building houses and setting up rooms for them than I ever did changing their clothes or doing their hair. Never really did any of that. When we would go to Costco, my mom would just drop me off in the front at the box area, and she'd do her shopping and I would pick whatever box I wanted to use to, you know, build a dollhouse with.
Yeah.
I'd go home and I'd have a new craft project. So just things like that. I've always been interested in building. I also grew up in a cul-de-sac, so I did a lot of chalk master planning over the summer, and my neighbors would commission me to draw their houses and kind of organize where things would go in the town. So I've always kind of both large scale and small scale have leaned towards those things that architects do. So I'm very privileged to have been able to follow that passion and be an architect now.
Yeah. So what's your feedback on the Barbie dream house, both in terms of architectural integrity and aesthetic, you know?
Yeah, the Barbie dream house was something that I always wanted, but never had. I remember we had like a knockoff one in my preschool, and that was like the best toy ever. But I never had that at home. I never had a dollhouse at home. So I had to build all of that myself.
Yeah.
So it was, that's kind of not having that. It was like, okay, I'm just going to make my own.
Yeah. Well, put it on your Christmas list for this next year. Maybe, maybe you'll get it now. All right. Well, let's get into what we're talking about today about getting into the design phases early. And I want to start with just, you know, a big sort of basic question for you. But if a manufacturer wants to get in and initiate conversations with you early in a project or early in the design process, what's the best way for them to begin that engagement with you?
Yes, I probably could start with the worst way is just
okay, that's
cold,
good. That's
that
good.
Cold LinkedIn of like, hi, I'm selling this. Can I talk to you? Mm-hmm. And I think that is a way, like when you're working on a project, maybe you're in the wrong phase or you're not looking for that specific product. That information comes in and you don't really retain it. I think it's really important to meet with an architect at the right time. You want to meet with them during that design phase, not during the construction administration phase, because products have already been selected. So I think creating that relationship where an architect is familiar with who you are, who your products are during, you know, early, like design or even earlier than that. So there's a lot of foundation, right? It's you have to have a presence online. You have to have reps that are willing to communicate. Maybe you have a presence at a convention that someone has walked by and kind of familiarized themselves with your product, or even lunch and learns. I feel like those initial introductions are all important ways to kind of form a relationship with an architect so that when we do get to that phase where we're going through our specs, we're talking to our clients, we're thinking about what options we are considering including in the project and how we're building things out. Then we think of your product and we reach out. And then I think from that point on, it's to be like very helpful and help us solve problems. And that's the folks that I can call and I know that they're going to help me solve my problems. Those are the reps that I go back to over and over again.
So let's go back to each of the things that you just sort of mentioned as channels, right? You talked about social media, you talked about events, and you really talked about lunch and learns. Am I missing anything that you said there? I don't think so.
I mean, wherever people are finding information or doing research too, to just be present on those platforms.
Yeah. So let's start with social media. Was it that you don't want to be outreached to on social media at all? Or was it that the outreach wasn't right or the time wasn't right? You know, how do you want manufacturers to engage with you on social media, if at all?
Yeah, I think it's all timing. If it's a cold outreach and I'm not looking for that product, it's kind of, I'm going to forget who you are. You're going to get lost in my contacts. That introduction in the inbox is going to just fall towards the bottom. But if I meet you at a lunch and learn, I'm interested, we connect, and then there's that LinkedIn ad or following on social media, then I know who you are and I'm familiar with your product. And then I think the foundation is a lot stronger starting from that point.
Do you follow brands, building manufacturers on social media? Like, do you follow their channels or their reps? Like, do you connect with them and you're open to that sort of exchange? It's just about the timing when it's occurring is what I'm hearing. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. So there's definitely, I would say, between like interior design leaning products and brands, they have a lot more of a prevalence on social media where maybe like my bat insulation or gypsum wallboard, you know, those folks aren't as active on social media. But I know a lot of, I was just looking at Fire Clay Tile. They have a beautiful, like inspirational Instagram where they have products and beautiful, you know, examples of how their products are being used, but they also offer a scholarship. And I was just looking at their information for, I believe it's a scholarship to Black women in architecture. And so they're advertising that and encouraging people to apply. And that's something where I'm like, oh, I'm definitely behind this. Let me reshare and interact with this more because this is information that should get out there because they're really contributing to the profession in a positive way.
That's awesome. Well, and you just got a chance to put it out there, right? You know,
so, yeah, apply.
Yeah. All right. So then you talked about events, right? So actually you and I met at an event, right? We met at AIA last year. So when you're talking, as people are starting to think about their booths and their experiences for AIA this year or other shows that are coming up, what is it that you're interested in hearing from a manufacturer other than being in a CEU, right? You know, in their actual booth, like how do they best approach you? What kind of information do you want them to have? Do they need swag? Do they not need swag? Do you throw it away? Like, help answer some of those questions.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some gimmicks that get people there. I'm thinking of the AIA conference in 2024 that people had puppies, people had drinks. You know, I have my Armstrong. I have a beaker because they all dressed as scientists and they were handing out potions. Gimmicks like that are, you know, they get people in. I think one team was giving out nail polish and Yeah. Bags and all
I got that. The nail polish. I think that was actually a technology platform.
So,
was Sherwin. Actually, I think that was Sherwin-Williams. Yeah.
I think it was Sherwin.
Yeah.
My friend picked up that nail polish, but I went with a bag from Benjamin Moore, and the Sherwin-Williams folks went, "Oh my gosh, what bag is that? It's so cute." And then I turned it around. They're like, "Ah, Benjamin Moore." So,
Stab. Yeah.
I mean, the environmentalist in me is like, we don't need more little pieces of this and that. But I say that as I have a jar full of my pens from the conference and I'm using their notebooks and I use my tote bags from different things. So I think, you know, that's like the level of, you know, you have stuff at your booth, it gets people there. But when I plan out my tour of the conference floor too, I'm connecting with people that I'm working on projects with too. I want to talk to them in person. I remember I had to go pick up some samples from Asa Abloy because the rep couldn't make, I am based in DC and that's where the conference was. So I picked up my samples from him and I had some roofing questions. So I went to GAF and then the Glengarry rep was there too. And we're using brick on a project. So I was like, okay, I'll swing by. And she had a demo and we actually were looking at something that I was thinking about swapping out one of our typical details for one of these new products. So I think that's the second level too of let people know, oh, are you going to the conference? We're working together. Stop by our booth. Let's make that in-person connection. You can physically touch some of these samples. And then it's also a good time too to debut some new stuff too of, you know, you're using these products. We've worked together, but we also have this and I can show you that.
Yeah. To help tell more of that full market basket story. Because I do think with, especially with large building product manufacturers, you learn about them from a certain product and they might have more, but you tend to think of people in the way that you met them, right? Versus like all the things that they have to offer. So there's a lot of opportunity for more cross-selling and upselling across the category.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just on that note, Caitlin, like you mentioned something interesting. I think both with events and social media, it seemed like you talked a lot about brands or reps you already know, maybe there's a relationship with, or you already have some engagement, some interest in them. What could manufacturers do on these platforms, maybe also during the lunch and runs, let's say, to get your interest when there isn't a pre-existing relationship?
Yes, I think that might be if I'm looking for a solution to something that I'm not quite sure what product I need, right? Like I think when I'm trying to think of like the PVC flooring, that was something that Armstrong Flooring had. And everyone was like, okay, we don't want to have PVC in our like vinyl tiles. Armstrong has a good solution. Well, when Armstrong went out of business, their flooring department, it was like, oh no, who do we go to now? And there was kind of this open market of which product is going to come out to be like, who are we looking to specify next? And I think that is one where it must be tough for manufacturers to optimize their SEO, to optimize their web presence of when I do that search on a platform like AceLab, or I do a Google search, who is coming up, and to have a good presence where it doesn't just look like mom and pop selling, you know, building products out of their garage, but they have a professional website where you go, oh, this, like, you know, I can find all of my lead information here. Depending on what the product is, there's different information you look for. But if you can find all that information on the website, or if they have resources like installation details, I think of a resource like the International Masonry Institute. So the project I'm working on right now, we're doing natural stone and brick, and it's more of like a classic collegiate Gothic building. But I was on that website during the detailing almost daily of just, okay, here's a detail, but our situation's a little unique. How can I modify? And I was calling the team. And the International Masonry Institute is a group that I probably like 10 Yeah, probably like at least 10 years ago, I did a tour of their facility and they did a workshop, a day-long workshop where I tiled a shower, I laid CMU, I laid a brick wall, and I had, and you know, then there was like a CEU component to it as well, but I had so much fun and I learned so much about doing that work physically, and that has stuck with me where now that I'm working on, I typically work on more modern buildings or a lot of adaptive reuse. But for this building, I was like, okay, I really need to up my game in terms of the brick and the natural stone detailing in terms of our exterior wall systems. I thought, who do I go to? And I went, oh, the International Masonry Institute. They have all those details. So I was able to just use those resources and then connect with their vendors and, you know, preferred products and all of that. And they were a great help to work with our design team, our technical team, but also run some options by them.
So tell me more about the websites you mentioned also in there. That was something that was, so you go, you're evaluating. It sounded like when you're looking for new products or you're early in design, before you're reaching out to anyone, you're in front of your computer and you're gathering information before you begin your outreach. Fair assessment of the situation?
Yeah, I think I work for a larger firm, so a lot of that research too. The first thing I do is I send a message in the Zoom chat of, mm-hmm. We have our technical channel, our architecture channel, and it's like, hey, what have people used? And what did you like? What did you not like? And then people share stories of, you know, this was really successful 10 years out. It's wearing really well. Or I use this and we had an issue with the warranty, or, you know, whatever it is. But that's my first spot. And then I would search for those items online or on a platform to kind of learn more and see if those would be the right applications for my project.
Mm-hmm. So when you get to the website, you've heard from someone, you know, product ABC, double thumbs up, and you go to the website. How often is the website giving you double thumbs up vibes? And how often is it like, whoa, they must have really been looking hard to see the beauty here? You know, like,
yeah, I think it depends. Yeah. I think when I have to put in my email over and over again to download things, that's just like, oh man, what am I signing up for? You know, I just want to know if this product will work. I want to get their technical data. Or sometimes it's really helpful too if we're doing in a project right now, some operable doors. So like a garage door, but inside. And so it's really helpful to go to those product websites and pull the family, the Revit family, and then we can put it right in our model. I mean, sometimes you have to purge some things because they really load them up with a lot of information. But after that purge, then you put in your model and you're showing the client. And even from early design phases, if they're seeing XYZ door over and over and over again, then they have it in their mind that I'm getting that door. So even when it comes to like a VE process, they're like, well, I kind of wanted this door that I've been seeing this whole time. And it's like, yeah, all of our renders have shown it. And that's the preferred product that we have.
So should all brands be investing in BIM? Are there certain categories that you think don't need to be there? Or how important is that in making a decision like between brands, right? Because I think most brands have it, but still not everybody, right? So for the people who haven't jumped in yet, help explain why they should.
Yeah, it really depends on their users. I mean, there's probably still some firms that are just doing CAD, so they would only need CAD details. I'm working mostly in Revit, so it's helpful to have Revit details. And not even all of our details aren't even 2D anymore. Sometimes we have 3D details in our construction document set to really illustrate the complexities of that wall assembly. And the more we model things too, depending on what the delivery is, our engineers are looking at those elements too. Our contractors are sometimes in our models. And so it really helps us model to what is going to be built, especially with the complexities of Revit. But yeah, if it's a product that maybe doesn't need that, maybe the technical details are more helpful of how can I then reference, I can load those details into my project and then add on the additional wall systems, or the profiles can be loaded in or something like that. So I wouldn't say it's necessary for all. I'd say companies like furniture companies, we definitely love those models. Yeah. Maybe if it's like a roofing system, that's maybe where you have your details that architects can reference, but you don't need to have the flat roofing material or whatever, because we can easily mimic that in our model.
Mm-hmm. And how often do you find, like in your own work at your firm, that you are exclusively looking for those branded BIM files from a manufacturer, as opposed to having an internal library where we say, okay, that is an X operable door, and we're just going to call it the name of manufacturer that we're interested in, as opposed to downloading one separately for every single manufacturer explicitly, that'll go into the project.
Yeah, that varies. I think we have a lot of standards. So I have a big firm, we have a big library, there's a lot of standard things that we bring in. But sometimes those one-offs become standards of, I used it in this project, it was successful, you know, we strip it so that it's a more simplistic model and we can reuse that. Other times I'm thinking about using like an operable partition. So if we have two classrooms that are adjacent to each other and we want a soundproof partition, but it could be operable, that is something where we're working directly with the rep of this is the acoustic performance we need. This is the length of the room. This is the type of track. This is the type of structure we have. And that piece is, we could put a, just like a regular family in, but we do get a custom, like we get custom shop drawings and then we are modifying a family to fit that. So those like early design drawings are really helpful because then we can size it. We know the panels, the panel sizes, which then influence the pocket size, which we have to model around. It helps us place our structural beams and coordinate kind of what is the soffit around that piece of if it's ceiling mounted. So those early shop drawings, I know often there's complexities of like, we're not modeling until we know that it's being bid or pricing. And I totally understand that. So whatever that timeline is, it is helpful eventually to have those shop drawings that we can then include in our construction drawings so that everything is coordinated.
Is that something that manufacturers can offer as a point of differentiation, those that are willing to invest earlier to support you with that sort of technical detail? Will that help you make you more loyal to them if they're in early at the design phase? I mean, we see it a lot where it's like, and it happens in advertising too, in marketing also, you know, you do all this spec work with the hope and a prayer that it comes back to you, right? You know, so does that make, will you be like, if someone tries to VE it out or someone tries to flip it, are you going to be like fight for that harder because they've been with you and invested early? Or is it just at the mercy of, you know, the whatever the estimate comes back at and, you know, like it's out of your hands at that point?
Yeah, I think that's, It's at a certain point, it is the contractor, right, who's selecting a lot of these items. But in our specifications, we can include, you know, it has to be this basis of design product, or we could have an alternate. And it really comes down to how the specifications are written for those items. There has been a lot of pricing volatility. I'm sure we've seen with construction projects in the recent years have kind of skyrocketed in a lot of different ways. So oftentimes our contractors are looking for ways to save money on different products. So things, I mean, it's a reality of working in the market, and things get VE'd and we have to be adaptable to those things. But where a product is maybe part of like a building system that we've designed our wall system around, or we have a specific R value, or it's a certain thickness, or there's some type of like special performance that we've designed the system around, that's when it's a lot harder to VE that because it would trigger an entire system redesign. Mm-hmm.
I was talking to someone this morning, this is kind of off topic, but you know, but timely related to my world. So, and I'm asking the questions, right? So they were asking, how do architects feel about value engineering? Does it frustrate you? Are you accepting of it? You know, if brands could come to you and say, we can help you because of their connectedness in the market. In this particular example, the manufacturer had really deep relationships all the way through with distribution and the contractor level. And they're like, we think we can help protect the spec better. They're trying to figure out how they go to the architect than others because of the way that we approach territory development. And so if we can tell them that we can help like monitor this, right? Would that be of value back to you? I said, I think it would save them time, right? You know, like if you can really deliver on that, I think that they would probably appreciate it because there would be less for them to review. They already have a really long punch list as they're going through everything. Like anything you can do to reduce that, I think would be of value. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think to respond to your earlier question of VE is just, it's part of the process.
Yeah,
I think it's balancing design goals, it's balancing client goals. Oftentimes, you know, it's not just the designers going, oh, we want everything to be clad in gold. Yeah. No, now we have to VE. But oftentimes the clients are like, well, this is our budget, but we would really like X, Y, and Z. And you try to design towards that aspirational element, setting realistic expectations of like, okay, everything that you want is going to be this price. And then when, you know, if we can't meet that or it's going to be too high, then what can we walk back on? And I think as architects, we have to strategize what that is, because it's always realistic that something will come up, something will change. I was working on a project that was insulated metal panels, and one of the plants had a fire and production halted. And then it was like, now there's a scarcity of these panels and this and that, and we have to just work around it. What can we do to kind of keep construction moving? So unexpected things happen. And as architects, we just know that we have to roll with it, and we're designers and we think creatively, and we can always kind of design a solution to whatever comes. So where we have designed building elements, we hope that we want to specify products that are sustainable, that are healthy for the inhabitants, and that are trusted brands. And I think a lot of us aren't just picking the coolest new thing because it's cool. It's okay, it might be cool, but is it going to perform like these trusted brands I know? And is it going to meet our sustainability requirements? Is it going to be, are the manufacturing processes ethical? I was recently interviewing someone who was talking about Design for Freedom, which is working to reduce prison labor in the construction of building materials. And that was actually the first time I had heard of that organization. And it's like, oh my gosh, we should probably do a sweep of all of our specifications to check for these products, because things like that matter, right? Like, we want to reduce carbon in the creation of these materials. But, oh, if it's being made by forced labor, that is absolutely unacceptable as well. Like, we really should consider where things are coming from.
That's really interesting. So I think you made a very important point, which I feel like most manufacturers are aware of as well. And some try to keep things that way, some try to change it, which is most of the time architects are going with what they know. And often that tends to be the trusted brands, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's all the reasons in the world why it makes sense for an architecture firm to do that, why it makes sense on a project. But let's say you are in the shoes of a manufacturer that is a smaller player, but can help you as an architect to optimize on the cost, the sustainability, the aesthetics, you know, the design options and so on. They're just not that trusted brand yet. They're not the status quo. What could they do to get you to trust them, to use them, instead of feeling like you would be the guinea pig and like there's nobody else that has actually used them in the past? And you don't want to be the guinea pig either. Mm-hmm.
I would probably call another architect that used their products, or I will call an owner who has a building that has their products in it. That's what we've done. So the project we're working on, we called another architecture firm that designed a local university, and we were kind of going for the same similar look, right, of natural stone and brick. And we had specific questions about the shingles. And it was a product that we typically hadn't used, because asphalt shingles aren't something that we are using all the time in higher education. But this product or this project, we were specifying them. So I called the architect and I said, hey, which products did you use? And do you like them? Do you feel like it's holding up? What types of things did you consider when you were designing the project? And they gave me the green light of, this is what we used. We like this. It's been, you know, so many years since the project's been constructed, and the, you know, owner seems happy with it, and performance and maintenance and all of that was fine. So I went, okay, great. So well, then we proceeded. I engaged with them. I saw them actually at the AIA conference and was asking, I don't know if I got samples at that point, but was talking about some of the detailing elements. And then we coordinated with their team to work through a couple of the unique examples that of just kind of our eaves that we had in our building. So I think if it's something that I don't know about, I'm going to look for the information. I know smaller manufacturers might not have the resources to pull all of those EPDs together or provide the documentation because it's expensive and it's very laborious to pull that. But for lead projects that require that, that might eliminate them as a consideration. Or if they're not within a specific geographic region, that might also discount them for some projects. So if they get past those two phases and they do still qualify, then I'm calling people and I'm saying, okay, I want some photos of your stuff installed and who can I call to see if they're happy with that or not.
That's super interesting. So it sounds like in those situations, you would either go to a source you trust, which might be another architect that you like and respect, or you'd be looking for a case study of some kind. It could be where has this been used or some maybe some inspiration images on the website, which can just help you to build the confidence that it won't be the first time that anybody's ever used that product before.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the questions that manufacturers can ask you that you think are really helpful in terms of information that you want to share with them earlier in the design phases versus questions that might be off-putting or be like, ugh, I just want to get you off the phone, or, you know, why did I even sign up? Why did I give you my email? You know, like,
yeah. Well, I know that manufacturers, they want to know the project name, the project location, maybe budget, but I probably wouldn't ever even share that at that point. But they want to know my email. And sometimes I just want to call and say, I have a random question. I want to ask this in the void.
Yeah.
And then I want to be anonymous.
friend was asking me.
Yeah. I have a burner email account that you do. I totally get that, right? It helps their tracking purposes to know who's contacting them about what project. And, you know, you got to provide that sometimes. It's just part of doing business to get information. So, but I my preference is that I just want to call and be like, hey, I have a question. I'll contact you again when you know, we're moving forward. Or I just wanted to pick your brain about a good product to use or something like that. And then once we move forward with accepting that product in the project, then that's when it's like, okay, this is the space we have. This is our wall. You know, this is our climate or whatever it is to work through with them. That's when I'm feeding them all the information and looking for that solution.
Mm-hmm. Are there ways that manufacturers could be approaching that initial conversation? Like, you pretend like you didn't reach out, they're reaching out to you for whatever. And so who's they're the ones asking the questions. Like, are there manufacturers that you can think of that do a better job, you know, in that upfront sales process, really, in terms of, if they're good at sales, they're asking you leading questions that are getting you to share information that they can then actually say whether they're the right solution or not, and then tell you, you know, if yes or no, because, right, you don't want to waste anyone's time. And if they're good at their job, they don't want to waste their own time trying to push a product on you that's not going to be a match for the project that you're working on, right? So are there, as you think about the ones that do it well, mm-hmm. Is there anything that you can offer in terms of advice or guidance for those early conversations for how a manufacturer should approach you or the types of questions that help you actually think about the project and what you're building?
Mm-hmm. I think that the lunch and learn is a great format for that, where mm-hmm. It's kind of, here's our information. And then at the end, do you have any work or what are you working on? How can I help you? What a colleague of mine has set up at our office, which is actually really successful, is we'll have I guess it's kind of like a show and tell. So mm-hmm. We'll have four or five reps that come in and they're non-competing products, but in all different industries, architecture, interiors, and they can lay things out. And then we walk around and touch things and pick things up and get business cards. But that is an informal way to have a conversation of, this is what you had said earlier, Megan, of this is what we have and you're familiar with this, but we also have all of these different products that you're not familiar with that we'd like to introduce you to. And I think that is a great, instead of doing just the one lunch and learn at a time, my colleague was very smart to kind of pack everyone together, because then it's more informal and we're milling around and you don't feel like you're just sitting there for an hour, but you can have conversations. And maybe you're working on lighting, so you talk to the lighting person, or maybe you're working on exterior, so you're talking to like a cladding person. and you can have those smaller conversations in that at that one time.
Is it a lunch and learn like for a CE credit, or is it more of like a PK session? Like, how does the education component come in something like, I mean, I love this. I haven't really heard of anyone doing that before, so I'm curious to understand it better.
Yeah, no learning component.
Yeah.
So sometimes there is a food component, which is a good draw, but it's really, if you're in the office that day, I think it's just a great time to kind of go see some products, and especially the interior design folks. I mean, the tiles and the acoustic panels and the floors. I mean, I am not seeing those on a regular basis, all the big layouts of just all of the different options. So it's a great way to kind of jog your memory of, oh, I'm working on a project and we're going to need acoustic panels. So this is actually a great solution and I'm going to keep them in mind. And that really opens the door of just being familiar with that person. And then you've gotten their business card that day. Maybe they've connected with you via email. So then you can follow up when you have that time where you need to reach out.
Who's the colleague that coordinated that? What's their role in the organization?
So I believe it's my colleague, Karen, to give her a shout out. And she is an interior designer. Okay. So I know, I think we do that in our Baltimore office too, but I'm not sure who has coordinated the more. There's one woman who does all the lunch and learns, but then I'm not sure if this like kind of show and tell is someone else.
Yeah, because I think it could be an interesting idea for manufacturers to bring to architecture firms that maybe aren't doing it, right? Say, hey, are you guys doing this? Like, we could do it. Maybe they have, you know, everyone knows someone everywhere in building materials, right? Like, hey, we could even help potentially. Like, would you be interested in doing it for a specific project that you're working on? Or I think it could be an interesting way for a rep to bring value back to the architecture firm if it's not something that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's a great format. And to your point, I mean, if like these reps who know each other fairly well in this industry, if there were like reps who are already aligned in that they're from two different manufacturers, non-competing, that both have a very good application for healthcare, they say, hey, why don't we like pitch the three or four of us? We go to architecture firms and say, we're offering this like tabletop experience and we bring food as well.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like lunch
and lunch. Right? Yeah. Yeah. It's so much more efficient. And plus like for like the more sort of like diversity in architecture firms, especially the mid to large size ones, I think it makes the conversations very focused as opposed to everybody being in a lunch and learn where it's good for the crowd and you feel good that you spoke to like a big crowd of architects or designers, but not all of them may be super relevant to like what you do as a manufacturer. I do want to just emphasize though, I mean, I feel like this early in the project thing to me always feels like it's about, you know, it's the chicken or the egg problem. If manufacturers made no effort to reach out early through a LinkedIn post or anything of that nature, then they also just have like zero shot at being able to make a connection. I think like for them, sometimes it can be a spray and pray approach that we'll just reach out to 1,000 architects. There's probably like five of them who need us right now, and then it'll just happen to be the right thing at the right time. But even for the people that do still want to keep on going with that approach that are like reaching out to you right now, do you have any feedback on what might be better things to bring up or to introduce themselves or the product instead of just what are the project details? How much does it cost? Who's on the project team? Give me all the details.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I am not the best person. And I want to admit, like when I get a cold call, I'm just kind of like, I'm sorry, I have a million things to do. It's not the right time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not terribly receptive. I would hope that I'm polite and I try to say like, I'm sorry, like I am in CA, I'm not specifying anything right now, or I just reviewed all of those submittals. It's on the job site already. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know if maybe if there's like any, I was just thinking like if there's any education through contractors of, you know, we see a lot of, the project I'm working on right now is design, bid, build, but maybe if there's like a design, build structure, if those manufacturers are close with the contractors, then the contractor can say like, hey, this product will, it can be installed in, you know, lower temperatures and we're working through the winter, or this is a good solution that will expedite this process because the drying time is quicker or something like that. Or this is a system that we can install instead of many of these parts and pieces, which will save us time and money. So perhaps during those early conversations when the contractor is coming and saying, hey, I have experience with these products, or this is a new thing that I want to try and it's vetted, that could be a great way to get in early rather than just like a, hello, have you heard about our fireproofing? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, I'm just going to archive that because it's not the right time. Yeah. So I would love to say that, oh, I read every message and I love when people reach out, but it's, there's just so like between email and text and Zoom chats and LinkedIn and other social media, there's just a lot of communication. Yeah. So I would say getting it word of mouth, potentially during that, I'm thinking like during the, like a design build project where the contractor can suggest those things, that could be a really powerful way to reach the architect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that don't forget about the strength of your install, like whatever you've done to build your contractor installation force, right? Don't forget about that when you're in the specification phase. Like the architect might be more interested in understanding that than people are indexing on.
Yeah. I mean, there's something special about each product, right? That makes it better than its competitors. And the person that can tell that story are the manufacturers and their reps. Mm-hmm. So it's how do you get that information to the person that's specifying, right? Does it have to go directly to the architect because it's like a design choice? Is it maybe a trusted product that's, if say we work for like a university system, they're only specifying XYZ ceilings or XYZ floors because that's the trusted product. Like that could be a great way through. Or is it through the contractor where, hey, the install is going to be magical. Yeah. You should keep us in mind.
Yeah. Well, Caitlin, that was super informative. I think that idea about the interiors or, you know, the everyone coming together, maybe you'll see an explosion of that happening. We can, you know, trace its origin back here to the podcast.
Yeah. trace it to my colleague because it was her idea.
Yeah, to Karen.
I didn't attend.
To Karen. You know, yeah. So the last thing that I want to ask you is more about your experience with architecture personally. So what is your favorite building that you've ever visited and why?
This was a tough one when I saw this question because I just, every new place that I go, I'm always fascinated by it. But when I was thinking, I don't know why, but the Salk Institute kept coming to mind, perhaps because we've been having the most like snowy, dreary, gray winter here. Mm. And when I had visited, it was just beautiful blue skies and there were hang gliders going all off the cliffs right next to it. So just they were above and in front of the Salk Institute over the ocean and just the pure materials and beautiful forms and kind of dynamic workspaces, but also kind of a peaceful design of that space. Just Lucan hit it out of the park. So right now or today, as I'm answering this, the Salk Institute is going to be my favorite.
Painted a beautiful picture there. It feels like a movie scene is what you're describing, you know, something that's like not even real, but it is real, right? You know, so. Well, thanks, Caitlin. Thanks for it on. And thanks everyone who tuned in and listened today. We hope you'll join us on another episode of Inside the Spec soon.